The invisible man we were talking about a little bit earlier. And you noticed on the sheet, my theme is our invisible friend. I'm sure there isn't a parent in the room here who wouldn't be able to bring you some story about invisible friends. I'm not going to embarrass the particular member of my family who used to frequently bring a friend home and go and play with this friend at some considerable length. And whenever something went wrong, it was always Bob did it. Bob did it. And I understand that somebody had somebody called Mr. Nobody at one point. I don't know if that's true, but I think there was various people have had invisible friends. Now, I've had mature adults basically reduce my faith in God to your invisible friend. You've just got an invisible friend, like Bob, somebody to blame things on, a crutch that I can lean on, somebody who's not really there, a figment of my imagination, an invisible friend. And all I can say to those people is, I have got an invisible friend. I do. I have an invisible friend. And he walks with me, and he talks with me, and I know him, and he hears me, and we do things together, and I'm so grateful for my invisible friend. Especially when it is clear that my invisible friend is not just a boy of my own age, as it were. It's God. God is my invisible friend. He's my friend. God is my friend. This is a wonderful, great, and glorious truth. Though you have not seen him, we haven't seen him, you love him. It's an amazing fact, isn't it, that Peter's writing about. Even though you do not see him now, there's a sense of hope there, isn't it? We'll talk about that in a later. You believe in him. That's a present tense, isn't it? Now. People say to me all the time, I haven't seen your God. When I see him, I'll believe in him. No, you won't. The time to believe in God is now. And this faith, this confidence that this Peter is writing about says that fills people with an inexpressible and a glorious joy. For you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Things I'm going to bring out. Three themes I'm going to bring out. The first, you notice it from the first line there. You love him, loving our invisible friend. Secondly, believing in him, putting your trust in him, loving him, trusting him, believing in him. We see that in the second line there, but you believe in him. And thirdly, receiving from him. Receiving. He's a God who gives. He gives us so much. Receive from him. Love him. Trust him. Receive from him. Invisible friend, 1 Peter 1:9. So I don't even want the passage open in front of you, because if you've got it, you can refer to other things that Peter has said in the lead up to these statements in verses 8 and 9. But I want to begin with my first comment on loving him because of this verse. Though you have not seen him, you love him. You love him. Now clearly, this letter is not addressed to everyone. The reason we know this letter is not addressed to everyone is because it is plain and evident that not everybody loves God. Have you noticed that there are lots and lots of people who do not love God? In no way, shape or form can we say that their life or their testimony expresses any love for God. This letter is written to people who love him. People who love God. That's who he is writing to. And when you think about what we've said before about this letter, who these people are, you can tell these people love God because they have been through so much trouble. Not as if trouble makes you love God, but the reason they've been through so much trouble is because they love God. Their troubles, their difficulties are a direct consequence of the fact that they are standing, believing, loving, testifying that there is a God, our invisible friend, and people have treated them so badly as a consequence. They've lost it all. They've lost their homes. They've lost their families. They've lost their friends. They've become refugees. They're asylum seekers in a foreign land where people speak a foreign tongue and have foreign practices and foreign ways and foreign gods. And they have started to have to start a new life in a new place with their faith and their trust in this friend they have, this invisible friend who they testify to that others cannot see, and they mock them and deride them, and their lives are hard. But that hardship is a voluntary hardship because it's their expression, their continued faith and confidence in making sure that people everywhere know he is. He is. That's who's been written to here. That's who this letter is addressed to. People like that. Christians. People who love God and stand for him. And Peter is very clear to them. They haven't seen him. You haven't seen him. This is amazing, isn't it? These people are prepared to go through all these troubles for someone they have never seen in their life. Well, if you think about it, lots of people are influenced by people they've never met. You could say communism. How many communists ever met Lenin or Marx? And yet they're still influenced by people. It's very common that people are influenced and moved and their lives are transformed by people they've never actually met or experienced physically, never met face to face. There's nothing particularly strange about that. And it's particularly not strange when you take into account that we're talking about God here and nobody's seen God. Because he is invisible. So why does he say this is a strange thing, you haven't seen him and yet you love him? Because, well, that's the most obvious statement in the world. Nobody's seen God, right? Because he's invisible. Of course they haven't seen him. But there's another angle on this. They, this particular group he's writing to, haven't seen him. But Peter has. And John did. And Andrew did. And all sorts of people saw him. Because God came down into our world and took on the form of a man, born of a virgin, walked amongst us, lived amongst us, 30-something years, eating, breathing, speaking. God came down. And a very small, limited number of people, at a very small, limited number of places, for a very short, limited amount of time, saw God in the flesh. They handled him, they heard him, they saw him, and they testified who he was. God manifest in the flesh, the second person of the Trinity, God the Son. Jesus said in his own words, if you've seen me, you have seen the Father. He's saying, you haven't seen him. These Christians are, this is the ordinary Christian experience. 99.99999% of Christians have not seen Jesus Christ. But this little tiny rump group met him. And our confidence and our faith is based on the testimony of this tiny little minority group of people who said, I saw him. And they have built their confidence and built their faith on the testimony, what has been said by this very small group of people. This is the ordinary Christian experience, not to have not just seen God, but not to have even seen God in the flesh, in the form of Jesus Christ as he came amongst us. That's the ordinary Christian experience. You have people in certain movements that tell you, I saw Jesus. I don't know. They may have had a vision, an impression on their hearts. Fine, I'm with that. But Jesus is in heaven, bodily, physically in heaven. He's not here in the earth. Whatever they saw, it wasn't Jesus physically, bodily in the earth. Because he's not here. He's in heaven. And these Christians hadn't seen him, and we have not seen him. Him. You see, it's not just when he's talking about him here. We're not just talking about God. We're talking about God in the person of Jesus Christ, who is God. Every bit as much as God the Father, as we talk about God the Father, every bit as much, Jesus is God. Man and God. Him. And these Christians love him, even though they haven't seen him. And that is the normal Christian experience, isn't it? Yet you love him. Yet you love him. You love this person that you have never seen. It's one thing to love an invisible friend, but this is something you've never seen, yet you love him. That's extraordinary, isn't it? But when you think about who he is, when you think about what he's done, how can you help but love him? How can you help but love the one who made the blind to see, who made the dead, who made the lepers clean, who raised the dead? How can you not love the one who walked on the water and said, blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek? How can you not love the one who gave himself physically, bodily, over, to be handed over, to be betrayed, to suffer and to die and to suffer cruel nails and a crown of thorns and the reproach of men, that his shed blood might be the forgiveness of sin for sinners who put their trust in? How can you not love him? Such grace, such love. Him. God is love. God is love. We spoke to the young people at the Good News Club on Friday. I said, one of you, please tell me one thing that Jesus Christ has ever done wrong. Tell me one thing that you can accuse him of. One sin. Nothing. Nothing. Without sin, God is love. And Jesus is the exact representation of his being. He is the image of God because he is God. That's why you love him when you know him. You don't have to see him to feel his power at work in your life, to know his love and to love him back, because it's irresistible, because he is lovely. He is lovely. Altogether lovely. There's nothing about him that you can say is not lovely. And so we love him, though we haven't seen him. How can we do this? How can we love this person that we haven't, even though you do not see him now? This is the next part of our these verses. You believe in him. This is it, isn't it? How can you love somebody you can't see? Through faith. Believing. That's the important verse, isn't it? Faith. Now, he says, even though you do not see him now. Yes? So he is testifying, Peter is testifying, that he saw him physically. He saw the things that happened. Almost certainly, Peter is the man who dictated to Mark the Gospel of Mark. And if you want to know what Peter saw, read Mark's Gospel. Peter saw Jesus and knew he was God. And he has his testimony, his evidence is written for you in this book. Read it. These Christians he's writing to haven't been in Jerusalem at the time when Jesus was there. They never met Jesus. They didn't see the miracles. They're living the second generation. They're in the same situation, the same boat as you and I. They haven't seen Jesus. But he says, even though you do not see him now. You don't see him now. But what's this little word now telling you? You will. You will. Because this is the amazing thing. This tiny little group of people, in this very short window of time, in this very limited number of places, for a little season, saw him. And now they're telling people who are telling people who are telling people and telling people, and the word is going out and filling the world. And people are believing throughout the world. But this is the amazing thing, that every single life, everybody on the face of the globe, in the far-flung islands, in every tribe, every tongue, every nation, throughout history, time immemorial, their lives, their souls are moving intractably in the same direction. And do you know what they're going to find and meet at the end? Everybody. The Bible says, every eye will see him. Every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess, because on the day of judgment, we will see and know that Jesus Christ, Jesus is Lord. He'll be there judging the living and the dead. We will all see him. We all will. Even though you do not see him now, we will. We will, every one of you. It's not through faith, the eyes of faith, that you'll see him there. You will see him in your physical eyes, because God is going to raise the dead. And though you're living now, and when he comes, or if those who have died, they will be raised, and physically in our bodies, we will all stand before God. And we will be judged. Believe in him now, then. Believe in him now. That's how you see the invisible God. The only way you can see God now is through the eye of faith. You have got to have some faith. You've got to have some trust. If you're going to talk to the invisible God, if you're going to pray, you've got to believe that he's there and that he hears you. Otherwise, you are just going through a piece of theatre. But if you believe, you can talk to him. And if you believe, you will hear him speak to you. If you believe, he will change your life. And he will set you on a new path. And he will take you from where you are now. And he will take you all the way to heaven. These people, they loved him. They stood for him because they believed in him. They had confidence. They had trust. We're going to take communion in a few moments. Got to believe in him. If you're going to have communion with him, aren't you? Well, how can you have fellowship with somebody you don't even believe exists? Don't play. This isn't a theatre. This is the eternal, glorious church having communion with its God, who knows your lives, who knows what's going on in your hearts, knows whether you believe, knows all things. There's no mocking God. These people loved him and believed in him. Let's just look at these last verses. This is how believing and loving him changed them. They were filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy, because they were receiving the goal of their faith, the salvation of their souls. They were receiving from him. Something was being communicated by God to them. It wasn't just a one-way street. That word filled, they were filled. This glass is no longer filled. There is room for something else in that glass. These people were filled. That means there was no room for anything else. They believed. They loved. And that was the full experience. Being filled is a wonderful thing, isn't it? There is no room left for anything else, not for doubt, not for fear, nothing. You are filled. And that's what these people's experience was. Complete. A complete experience. But notice that the thing that they were filled with was inexpressible. I've pondered about this. Because how can it be that this experience, this joy, was inexpressible? That means you can't, does it mean you can't tell anybody about it? You can't show anybody to it? You can't share it with anybody else? Is that what it means for this joy to be inexpressible? To express something is to let it out. And personally, I take this line to mean this complete filling by the joy, the glorious joy, cannot leak away. It cannot soak away. It cannot evaporate. It can't be expressed as if you let it out, you lose something of it, and therefore it's diminished in you in any way, shape, or form. It's continual. The continual infilling of the Spirit is permanent and is absolutely without change. And its experience is qualified by this, a glorious joy. Now, that doesn't, when we let's think about the word glorious, we've spoken about it before. Glory is kavod, the meaning of weight or substance. It's the word that the Hebrews use to talk about significance, importance. This joy is so important. It's not slightly glorious, it is glorious. That's the full maximum quantity or quality applied to this word joy. It is totally significant. This joy you feel, this joy you know, that touches the inside of you, that warms your soul, that keeps you going. It's like a fire burning within you that never goes out. It's so important. It tells you something. It tells you that Christ is in you, doesn't it? It tells you that the covenant is real, doesn't it? It reminds you that God is, doesn't it? This constant, continual sense of peace and joy. And we read earlier in this book that these people are suffering all kinds of griefs. Does that mean that I should be in a continual ecstatic state? No. Because they're experiencing all kinds of griefs. Grief is an emotion. It's a real emotion, isn't it? They're having real problems, real concerns in this world. Yes, they are. But underneath, underpinning all these things, continually mitigating against that, stopping you from being consumed, always holding you up, is this joy, solid joy. You've got this invisible friend, and he's God. And he's with you, and you love him, and he loves you, and you have communion with him. Why is this joy there? Because they're receiving. I want to stress this. It's the present tense. It's not. They're not hoping to receive the salvation of their souls or the end of their faith at the end. It's now. Now they are receiving it at that moment, experiencing something taking place, the purpose of their faith. Where did the faith come from? It's a gift from God. You cannot work up faith. You cannot try to believe in something with all of your heart. You either believe it or you don't. And those who believe, given that faith as a gift from God, and it saves their souls. And it's been sent for a purpose, that they, in their situation, in their places, in their troubles, in their asylum-seeking foreign state, and all their griefs, they should be receiving continually this infilling, this refreshing by the Spirit, this joy, this assurance from God that he's with them, and he loves them, and they love him back. And the outcome of this is the salvation of their souls. My final comments. People agonize over this word, the soul, souls. They become very technical. And they divide the human being into all its compartments and categories. The body, the soul, the spirit. They subdivide us up. The soul is the conscience, the will, the emotions, the memory, so on and so forth. The body has its part, etc., etc. We are compartmentalized, and that is fine and good and useful in its place. But what does it mean here about the salvation of your souls? It is so simple. Your soul in this context is just your life. Your life in all its parts. Body, soul, spirit, emotion, memory, conscience, fingers, eyes, ears, feelings, the whole thing. Your life is being spared. Do you hear me? Your life is being spared. You're being saved. You are being saved. You're marked out. There's a mark on you that says, this one will not die. This one will not be judged at the end. This one goes free. This one lives forever. This one is my beloved. This one is my son. This one enjoys my favor. Your life has been spared through Jesus Christ and through what he's done. And if you are not filled with joy as a consequence of that, something that will keep you burning on the inside against all the cold winds that blast against you,